Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Senior Director of the Department of Community Projects and Partnerships of the Orthodox Union and coordinator and host for SPIRIT. SPIRIT was created several years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it as an online program for retirees, not yet retirees, empty nesters, baby boomers, sandwich generation parents, and seniors, everyone who is looking for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Now, as we know, during the pandemic, even as so many of us probably have been vaccinated, SPIRIT is still the perfect way to engage safely in a virtual setting. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and our program today is so appropriate for this theme. We will be hearing from Ruchama Bistritsky-Klapman, founding and executive director of MASC, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Saving Kids, and Dr. Debbie Ackerman, PhD, LCSW, CASAP. The mission of MASC is to ensure that all parents and caregivers in the community receive the resources necessary to help raise emotionally healthy families. MASC is now in its 24th year, serving over 112,000 families. Our topic today is achieving a stigma-free society for all mental health issues, how grandparents and older adults can be involved. It is my pleasure and honor to turn the Spirit Forum over to Ruchama Bistritsky-Klapman and Dr. Debbie Ackerman. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today.
Thank you, Judy. Good morning. And I'd like to thank the OU for working on stigma-free, entertaining the idea of helping families deal with all mental health issues, no matter what they are, whether they're something like ADHD, bipolar, schizophrenia, addictions, MASC. Just to give you a little background, MASC, I started it 24 years ago. Like Judy said, we have over 112,000 families that have participated in the MASC programs. We have a helpline, we're a referral organization. We offer parent support groups, which, by the way, Dr. Debbie Ackerman facilitates one of the support groups on Monday evening, which is has done tremendous for so many families, where they're able to move along and understand what their loved one, whatever mental health issue they may be struggling with, how they can help them. So MASC also, we have a radio show every Thursday night on 620 AM Radio Dial, which is the Zev Brenner station. You can get it on talklinecommunications.com. And again, working towards stigma-free is learning about these mental illness issues, educating oneself. And what better way is it than having publicly a radio show every week? I interview professionals so that we can get all the different mental health topics out there for the community, for everyone to listen to. You can go on to massparents.org and listen to previous shows that I interview therapists, parents, doctors, psychiatrists, all different professionals. So anyone interested, go on to massparents.org and listen to our shows if you can't get us Thursday nights. So one more thing, MASC has also an after school program for the younger kids. Our goal is prevention, prevention, prevention. And we do have a book club. You know, we every week or two, we put out another book that families can read about different topics that we speak about on our radio show, in our groups. Just to name a few, What Your ADHD Child Wishes You Knew by Dr. Sharon Saline, The Innovative Parent, Erica Curtis, Raising Connected, Happy, Successful Kids Through Art. Not everybody does well in talk therapy, and talk therapy is not always for young children a good idea. The Uncontrollable Child by Matis Miller, new book, wonderful book for everyone to read with young children. Addiction in the Family, Louise Danger, very important book if you're struggling with somebody that has an addiction. So let's go to the topic, you know, how could grandparents and adults, relatives, neighbors, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles help families when they are struggling with any and all mental health issues, which includes something like ADHD, bipolar, schizophrenia, addiction, molestation, porn addiction, whatever the topic may be, it's out there and families do struggle. So if somebody would have be diagnosed with diabetes, they would need to learn more about the illness. And the same with mental health. Our goal at MASC is to educate parents, family members, grandparents, to learn about the diagnosis before reacting, you know, by telling your daughter-in-law, your son-in-law, what's going on there with your daughter or son? What's going on with your husband? That's unacceptable or whatever. Get educated first. And Dr. Ackerman will speak more about that. I also just want to bring up a few topics which we will touch on, and that's HIPAA laws over the age of 18. If you have a child over 18 and you say to your daughter or your son-in-law, your brother or sister, you know, what's going on? What therapist is your child seeing? Maybe you're a therapist, you want to help out. Not all young adults over 18 want to share with their own parents. So lots of times that's an issue. Medicating kids in yeshiva with ADHD, school issues, hospitalization, so important. Are they going voluntarily into a psych ward or involuntary? And what are the benefits? And also rehab and sober living. So it is an honor for me to have on with us today Dr. Debbie Ackerman. Thank you for being on. Thank you, though, you and Judy Stein, and for all your wonderful programs. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning to everybody. Thank you very much to Rahama. Thank you very much to the OU for this wonderful opportunity. I do want to kind of just start by saying a lot of gratitude towards for Rahama and the tremendous work that she's done, which I've seen firsthand in several different ways. By helping student interns work there, by participating in her weekly parenting group. It really is an unbelievable service that MASC provides the community. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to say thank you and wish MASC continued success. So the topic of May is Mental Health Awareness Month is really fantastic. Mental illness is here. Mental illness has always been here. Mental illness will always be here. And for that very simple reason that we're all human beings and we have a brain. And if you're a living, functioning human being, you're going to have something. We all have a something. Now, does that something take over our life? Does that something really impede us? Or is it just what, you know, Freud liked to call a basic neurosis? You just have a something. Mental illness is really the only illness that is so highly stigmatized. Many times, the only way that we can diagnose mental illness, quite frankly, is by the way someone speaks or how they behave. They're doing more research now with PET scans and MRIs and this, but you can't really see a structural change in the brain unless, of course, the mental illness is because of a stroke or because of an accident or some other trauma to the brain. But we do know, for example, the rates of depression and anxiety and OCD are really now rising in the Ashkenazi community. And many people attribute that, quite frankly, to just the amount of trauma that we have survived. We are still very much of a post-Holocaust world. It has only been about 70, 80 years. There are still survivors that are grappling. And things trickle down into the new generation. But when we live in a community, and we have a wonderful community, and we are a community that is steeped in chesed, and we are a community that you can get everything from a free wedding gown to a free wedding to food delivered to your house and endless tzedakah and endless services, we tend to get very nervous with anything that has to do with mental illness. And that is because mental illness doesn't look right. People look wrong. They're not dressed the right way. They say the wrong things. They're reactive. They yell. They curse. They're not appropriate socially. All the myriad of things that, as Ruchama mentioned, if your child is ADHD, if your child is on the spectrum, if you're dealing with somebody with an addiction, there's your son-in-law weaving home from shul because he got drunk again. It's embarrassing. And the gut reaction to that is to push it away. I don't want to deal with it. This is not what I'm about. This is not my value system. This is not the son-in-law I wanted for my daughter. I want this out. I find that this topic of having spirit people, whether those are grandparents or aunts or uncles, or to be really very helpful in this topic. People who have what my grandmother used to call experience of life. My wonderful grandmother, and I was her favorite grandchild, she told me, so you all have to believe that. And she always used to tell me in her great German accent, I have experience of life. Well, that's a really wonderful thing when we start to talk about mental illness, because people have been down the road of life. You understand more, you have more to draw from. You understand patience, you understand process. You understand that things aren't going to happen quickly, which, by the way, is something that this generation suffers from, and it is really affecting us. I always tell my class, I teach a spirituality class, nobody wakes up anymore in the morning and puts up a tea kettle, or maybe, I don't know anybody, puts up a tea kettle to make coffee or tea. You either push a button, or if you like me, you kind of throw something that looks halfway normal over your, you know, whatever, and go out and grab a coffee. And we've become a very instant world. Right? You want to talk to Israel? Boom, you dial a couple of numbers. You want to talk to South Africa? Maybe you put another number in. I remember going to my grandmother's house every month so she could call her sister-in-law in Haifa. This was like a family event on a Sunday morning with her rotary phone. She's kind of like zero. We all watched zero until she got to Haifa. Of course, the circuits were busy. We stayed there for about an hour. She made contact with her sister-in-law, my great aunt. They shouted at each other in Hungarian and German and Hebrew for about 5 minutes. Hello, 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 hello. I love you, love you, love you. Clicked on the phone. And then we all had my grandmother's coffee, cake and coffee, and we took a nap. It was exhausting. I mean, this was just like a morning's activity. Nobody gets that. What does that have to do with mental health? Well, it has to do a lot. Because when taking a morning to make a phone call to Israel was an accepted thing, we also understood that things take time. There's a wonderful expression in the 12-step program of time takes time. And even the most benign, and I mean the most benign case of depression, anxiety, in my opinion, is going to take 18 months of medication management and therapy. The brain, which is the most marvelous organ in the world and is in charge of us being here, eating, speaking, drinking my tea, making wonderful conversation, is very slow to heal. This is not a Z-Pak that you take your kid or your grandchild or your great niece or nephew to the doctor, you get 2 doses, you start to feel better, 5 doses later, you're as good as gold. We need time. And I do believe that the spirit generation very much understands that concept of time and can partner with the younger generation. It'll be okay. Slow it down. Let's work with this together. We've got time. So I just kind of wanted to start the discussion with kind of that overview. Ruchama, is there anything you'd like to add or comment?
I think that it's really important that parents and grandparents realize when they find out that there's mental health issues that their family, their loved ones are struggling with, that they usually react negatively based on their own experiences, what they've seen from other people. So it's so important to learn about the diagnosis before we even, and we're concerned about shidduchim. Let's bring up that part, please, Dr. Debbie.
Okay. You know, I think if you go back through your family lore, you kind of go through your own family's genogram, and I've heard this from many, many families, all of a sudden somebody will kind of whisper under the table, well, you know, Uncle Baruch, he was meshuggah, remember? He was a bissel meshuggah. And you'll start to get like these kind of like little droplets of hints. So Aunt Fanya, I don't know how Uncle Hector put up with her. She was like a little whatever. So there is mental illness. If we can stop being scared of it, and if we can start to just understand it, when we name it, we tame it. And knowledge is truly power. As far as shidduchim, I feel like that perfectionistic complex that we all kind of do, no one is perfect. Mental illness is a part of life, just like people will present with diabetes and they'll present with kidney issues and they'll present with arthritis and lupus. Young people, people will present with illness. Our medications have gotten incredible. We are training therapists now, world-class therapists. I'm full-time faculty at Yeshiva University in the School of Social Work. We are demanding clinical excellence from our students. We are putting them in internships where they are on the ground and they are really seeing and working with and learning how to treat holistically, how to treat the individual with dignity, with compassion, with empathy. Some of the biggest proponents in mental health suffered from severe mental health issues themselves. For example, there's a woman named Dr. Marsha Linehan. Dr. Marsha Linehan invented what we call DBT, dialectical behavioral therapy. It is the number one empirically based modality for the treatment of people with borderline personality disorder. Nobody likes people with borderline personality disorder. They're reactive. They're black and white thinking. They're rigid. They can't hold on to any social relationship. They're really a very tough population. And Dr. Linehan has created this program, which has been shown to be effective. She came out recently, within the last several years, and started to speak about her own story, that she herself has borderline personality disorder. And for her entire adolescence, good chunks of it, she was put in a psychiatric facility in a padded cell in a straitjacket because she was hurting herself to such a terrible extent. She is a brilliant woman. I have taken her courses. I have read what she wrote. She has created an unbelievable therapeutic technique. The 12-step movement, which again is the number one program for people with addiction. It's free, it's peer facilitated, it's all over the world in millions of different languages and groupings, was started by two people who had alcoholism. And they understood if they talked to each other on what they called their experience, strength, and hope, that one alcoholic talking to another would be able to help move them further than anything else. Today, it's a licensing question on the social work licensing exam. If you have someone with addiction and you have one choice of treatment that you can do, the answer is you send them to a 12-step meeting. People that have mental processes, there could be a cognitive process, there could be a chemical process, or there could be a personality process or any of the other combinations. The person that you see morose and down and depressed is not going to respond to, well, let's just go get a good sandwich at the deli and then maybe we'll catch a movie or go a little shopping. That's being down in the dumps. That will respond to a nice afternoon. Depression, for example, is a real illness. The person feels awful. And the way that we can mark a depression is start to ask how you're feeling physically. Are you eating too much or too little? Are you sleeping too much or too little? Can you concentrate? Are you able to function? Can you take a shower? Because for people who are that ill with depression, the notion of getting up and taking a shower is purely overwhelming. It is having a systemic illness. The more we get to know, the more we get to talk, the more we talk amongst each other, and the more understanding and love we can have. In my addiction class, I just showed them a presentation from one of the leading rehabilitation centers in the United States. And one of the slides on the PowerPoint said, "We have learned that yelling at people with addiction or punishing them doesn't work." There you go. We cannot punish mental illness. You punish mental illness, the person will become more ill. People want a purpose. It is inherent in us from the time we are babies to the time we reach very, very, God willing, very, very old age, that we want purpose in life. The youth who are not working or not in school and we're getting mad at them, they want a purpose. They are at the moment not well enough to achieve it. And when the thoughts and the emotions in the brain are so jumbled, it is like rehabilitation. We can't jump into a 10-hour-a-day job, going to school, going out and socializing. We must keep the variables very steady until the brain learns new ways of coping and new ways of managing. Rahama.
Yeah, Dr. Debbie, you know, we talk about how grandparents could help, how neighbors and friends. And there are so many simple ways one could help. I'm talking about when somebody is suffering with mental illness and you have six other children at home, or a spouse that can't get out of bed and with anxiety, or a child or a spouse that is in an addiction facility or in a psych ward, the shoemaker and the cleaner still have to be taken care of. The cooking, challahs have to be baked or bought, Shabbos food, dinner, a fruit platter, lunch for the wife. I mean, there's so many simple ways. Right. And then for those that are across the world, you know, you can order an O'Nuts platter. We'll give a little ad for O'Nuts and send a platter for Shabbos and say, just wanted to bring some sweetness into your Shabbos. There are little ways that you can brighten someone's day without saying, you know, we had last night one of the groups that Dr. Ackerman actually facilitated. And one of the things that came up is people stopping you on the street and saying to you, oh, your daughter, I see she has piercings. She has, purple hair. Well, what school does she go to? I heard she was thrown out of the Beis Yaakov. Or where is your son now? I mean, I saw him hanging out with guys, you know, that are really not your kind of fellows, Dr. Ackerman. Do you want to touch on that and the reactions? A, how painful it is for the parent. Not everybody is ready to respond. And B, what good responses can be when they're asked that? Because even grandparents and relatives are asked that at a wedding. And they go, hi, Mazel Tov, how are you? You look beautiful. And then suddenly you're not prepared. And somebody says, how's your niece? I heard she's off the derech. I heard she's a drug addict, whatever. So if you could help us out with that, please.
I think that Rahama gives these really wonderful suggestions. And I think that if we look at mental illness for what it is, mental illness, it's a disease. And so every rule that you were taught or that your community taught you or that you kind of view yourself invented for somebody, your friends, your peers, people that you knew throughout your lifetime that weren't doing well, what helped at that occasion? Was it a jar of your delicious homemade pea soup that you just kind of put by their porch and it's for you? Was it like Rahama said, just calling and saying, you know what, I happen to be going out. Do you need some help with something? Can I, you know, drop off your cleaners? Can I pick up a couple of fruits at the fruit market? What people with mental illness want, or their families most of all, is what people with physical illness want most of all in their families. And that is to not be pitied and to be empowered. Any illness, any situation is going to make anybody feel like they're falling into the middle of a very big vortex, one that just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning and pulling you in where there doesn't seem to be an end. That could be a physical illness or a mental illness. If we are able to just, really one of the best lines is to just call or leave a text or a WhatsApp or an email. Today the choices are endless. Just say, hi, I am here if you need me. Let me know how I can be helpful, if and how I can be helpful. Now you have given power and dignity and choice back to the person that you wish to help. Maybe I don't want a casserole. Maybe with all this, you know, the medicine is causing my relative to have some pre-diabetic symptoms and a casserole's not it. But maybe if you could take my two-year-old to the park for an hour and I could just have a minute, that would be great. Allow the person to say something to you. I may be biased, and I admit that I may be biased, but I really did enjoy an extraordinarily special relationship with my grandmother. And it definitely wasn't based on anything monetary. My grandparents came to this country as immigrants after the war, very late after the communist revolution, that I have searched the world over for the same taste as my grandmother's coffee cake. And I've sampled every babka and kakash cake in the entire universe. I'm never going to find it, but I keep trying. I'm very valiant. I'm a really good researcher. I will never forget my grandmother sitting on my bed. I'm from Detroit, these cold winter mornings, feeding me little bits of her coffee cake with a really hot cup of coffee. That's what we did in our family. We're European, we drink coffee. There was nothing in my life that ever made me feel so cherished and so safe and so loved. Pitch black Detroit morning, it's freezing cold, and she's literally feeding me little bites of this cake and coffee. To this day, every morning I wake up and I'm like, I really want a piece of that coffee cake. I can't find it. And don't tell me to go to the bakery for the babka. I've been there. It's good. It's great. It's not my grandma's, right? It was not just the cake. It was love. I knew my grandmother loved me no matter what. And that was through my teenage years, my turbulent teenage years. There was my grandmother. Grandparents have this really incredible ability, because we really don't have all of the responsibility, that we can really be kulo love. Not money. Kids don't want money things. And if they do, it's a cover for what they really want, which is just love. Spending time, holding hands, proudly walking down the street with your ankle. I love you simply because you are. I never had to do anything for my grandmother. I didn't have to perform. I didn't have to get A's on my report card. I was her Debola. I was her favorite grandchild. Ask anybody in my family. Go ahead. I'll give you all their numbers. I was. And this, to this day, it carries me. I learned from it. I breathed it in. And it is really that love that you can show your grandchildren that they will remember. It's simple. It's having them sit with you at the table as you do your household chores. They can garden with you. They can go shopping with you. The youth of today, I really think, is dying for meaning and connection. Nothing connects them. Social media has a lot of barriers to it. There's an enormous amount of pressure in school for these kids. They're more confused than ever. They don't know how to be. All the social media, and yeah, I'm a victim, I do it. It is definitely changing their brainwaves. They don't have the attention that they used to have. And there is something so moving, so permanent, because maybe you do have more time than their parents. Maybe if you can devote just a little bit of quality time for the grandchildren, one at a time, or the one that's struggling. No matter what you do with somebody who is mentally ill, showering them and providing them with endless love does release good chemicals in the brain, and it's never going to hurt. If somebody is schizoaffective, if they have schizophrenia, if they have bipolar, if they're ADD, we tend to shut people with mental illness down. They're really bright. Having depression, having borderline, having ADHD, being on spectrum is not always necessarily a cognitive impairment. And they want to be heard. I think this is a really powerful way to connect. Does that make sense to anybody? Am I like making sense here?
Yes, thank you. Dr. Ackerman, I want to touch on another issue. And that is when family members struggle with mental illness and a wedding is coming up and they may be in rehab or sober living, or in a psych ward, in a hospital, or away in programs, whatever programs they may be in. So on our helpline, we get phone calls about, please help us get them home for the wedding, the offer. What am I going to tell my neighbors? What am I going to tell my grandmother? You know, when they say, where's your child that's missing? Right. And then they're going to find out for the first time. You know, I really want to thank the OU again, because we focus on the you. Where are you when the symptoms are happening? Where is that child that's focusing on the mental illness? And the OU, the O around the U, I want to say, you know, one child in a family that's struggling can really bring havoc to the whole family. Family struggle, husbands have to make a lot of money and pay for the bills for the rehabs that are thousands upon thousands of dollars. The wife is struggling with the other children answering questions. I really want to talk about how important it is to allow their loved one, maybe if the rehab or the hospital says they're not ready to go home for a simcha. So how important it is to let them stay in their treatment and miss that one simcha to be able to, with Hashem's help, be there in the future for many more to go to be.
I wasn't sure where you were going with this, but I'm like, wait, I know where she's going with this. Okay. I really think that if we look at this again in terms of the medical model, how can we look at this in terms of the medical model? If we had a relative that was at the hospital and hooked up to an IV to dialysis, we would not be asking for them to attend a simcha. If we had a relative who was in the hospital because their sugar was out of whack because of diabetes, we would not be saying, you know, just kind of get up and put a dress on. I'll bring you your dress and your shaitel and come to the wedding. I know you're not feeling well. You're kind of shaky. Your sugar's out of whack. You're sweating. You're trembling. Don't worry about it. I'll keep the cake away from you. We wouldn't dream of it. We literally would not dream of this. What we would do is we would say, you know what, Mary or whoever, Miriam is in the hospital. Who's going to go and be with her? Who can sit with her and maybe zoom in on the wedding and see what's going on while the rest of us attend the simcha? Now, when we have rehab, what are we rehabilitating? We're rehabilitating the brain, whether from addiction or from depression or from any illness that we can. The fact that the rehabs keep it very tight and locked is for the client's safety. And we need to keep the variables low. A recovering brain does need a tremendous amount of quiet, of routine, and of not excitement. Going to a wedding with all that stimulus and all that alcohol and all what's going on and all the family members that are so triggering could really relapse a person in a significant way. And if your relative is newly out of rehab and really shaky, it's almost like not hearing for years and then getting like an implant so that every single noise, the rustling of a computer, paper, the slurping of tea, everything kind of sets you off edge. That's kind of how the brain feels. The brain is very new and very raw. If they say to you, I can't go, respect that. No problem. Would you like me to stay with you? They're a chola. I can sit this wedding out. How about you and I? Let's sit together. We could have a nice evening at home. Let's maybe have a meal. We can talk, watch a little TV. Would that be okay with you? No, I don't want you to do it. I feel bad. No. This is my joy. I want to be with you. Weddings in particular, bar mitzvahs, family events, where you know that all eyes are upon you, especially if you're recovering from addiction, endless booze there. They're not strong enough yet. And we're really putting them in harm's way. It is literally putting a stumbling block before a blind person. It's a cause to fail. So let's just consider that. Rachama, is that helpful?
Yes. So let's just touch on, you know, masks. Slogan is, if you change the music in your home, your kids' dance steps could change. When I started MASC, it was for young adults. I'm a Nefesh International board member, an executive board member, which is a therapist, Jewish from therapists around the world. And Hashem Nefesh has almost 900 therapist members. So we're a referral agency, and we could connect families around the world with therapists for all different issues, get them into rehab if they need programs. We have a yeshiva liaison if you need a yeshiva for your child, a grandchild. So Mask is not Rachama Bistritsky Klatman alone. I have a wonderful, wonderful staff. We're located in Brooklyn, but we work really around the world. We've had groups, been to London and Toronto and Israel, and so many California where we've done programs. And with the pandemic, the silver lining was that we have Zoom groups for parents. So Debbie, Dr. Debbie, as you know, we have parents sitting in closets when they can't get away in the middle of the night. They don't want anyone waking up. They call from around the world, whispering, sitting in a car, sitting in a basement, sitting really in interesting places, just to be able to be on groups with other parents that are going through similar situations with their loved ones. Not elementary age only, not high school age, not married kids. It could be even elderly. Whatever the issues are, give MASC a call. I'll give out our number, 718-758-0400. And everyone should know, calls can be anonymous. Everything is confidential. And Dr. Debbie, you know, before we get ready to end, I'd like you to talk about the importance of confidentiality, please.
Okay. So confidentiality is really big. And the truth is that when you look at our wonderful Torah, everything that we do in psychology is right there in the good book or the good books, of which I have not delved into all of them, but I have enough people who have and who tell me. So between the Torah and between Hasidic thought and between all the lore that we have, really, honestly, it's the best manuals for psychology that I've ever and will ever see. Parenthetically, I think that's why so many Jews and Orthodox Jews tend to gravitate towards mental health services. It's really a natural fit. Our Torah very much values privacy and values boundaries, right? We know Matovo Ohalacha Yaakov, everybody lived in harmony, but in their own ohel with their own boundary. It's a very important thing. And I tell this to parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts all the time, to teach your children the difference between privacy and secrecy. Every single human being is allowed, afforded, accorded privacy. We all have our private thoughts. I can't read your thoughts, and you cannot read mine. Thank Hashem. And I hope we never get a machine that can do that. So you all have privacy. We teach our children from a very young age. You want to go into a bathroom? That's private. Privacy is an integral, important part of life. Secrets, as the 12-step saying goes, secrets keep you sick. When people want to hurt other people, children, abusive adult relationships, it's always done in secret. And that's part of the abuse and the manipulation, is to get that person to trust you, then start the cycle of abuse and not be able to break free from it. So the mental preparation for an abusive relationship is really intense and complicated, and that's for another time.
Dr. Debbie, I'm glad you brought up abuse. MASC works with families whose children may have gotten molested, and abuse is, you know, a double layer or a triple layer of secrecy. Many times it does not come out for many years. Young child gets molested at 7, 9, 11, before the bar mitzvah, whenever it is, and may not share with their family members for 5 or 10 years later. And all along those years, you may have left them to psychiatrists and therapists and got kicked out of every school and camp and sleepaway and day camp, you know, fighting at home, shalom bias issues happened as a result of it. But then you find out many years later they were molested. And I just want to end the conversation, if you could touch on the issue of that they are really the victims of the abuse. So if it's incest, which we have thousands upon thousands of cases of incest, that many times it's so hard for parents when one child may be molesting another child. So I really want to talk about that pain also when it's within the family, a grandparent molesting a grandchild, an aunt or uncle, or even an aunt or uncle being accused of, and then you go outside and it's plastered all over. So can we just touch on that, please? Thank you.
Molestation is one of those big dirty words that nobody ever wants to talk about, and that we kind of sweep under the rug and hope it'll go away. It's not going away. As long as there's people, there's going to be addiction, there's going to be molestation, there's going to be all of it. If you look at the national statistics, national, meaning it doesn't matter if you're red, pink, white, green, purple, Buddhist, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Episcopalian, it doesn't matter. 1 out of 4 or 1 out of 7, depending how you read the studies, children before the age of 18 will have an unwanted sexual touch. So if you choose to go to a ball game this summer, if that's your thing, or you choose to go to an outdoor concert or a museum or whatever, and you start counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, one out of that grouping will have had an unwanted touch before the age of 18. I'm no statistician, did really badly in that class, but that puts the rates of it much higher than even 1 out of 4 across a lifetime, because you're talking about the first 18 years of a child's life. The second thing to understand is 90% of kids who are molested by somebody who is known, familiar, and safe to them. An aunt, an uncle, a grandparent, a parent, a teacher, a softball coach, a B'nos leader, a Rebbe. Because molestation always comes with what we call grooming. And grooming is the psychological process where the molester brings that child in, and over 90% of the time, not only is it known to the child, but it is known to the parent. Groomers specifically target the parents of the child also, so that you will be confused, so that you will look at your child and say, what? No. I did hear a speech several years ago at one of the Nefesh conferences, and the presenter said, and I'll never forget it, he said, if a child comes to you and said that they have been molested or touched inappropriately in any way, you have 3 minutes to change the trajectory of that child's life. Anything other than, I completely believe you, this is not your fault, and we are going to get you the help that you need, will change your child's life permanently. Children don't lie to get into trouble. They lie to get out of trouble. And if they're coming forth with that type of accusation, I beg you, take it seriously. Take it seriously. It's a devastating diagnosis for a family. It will take many years of therapy and family therapy, but there is hope at the end of the tunnel. There is definitely hope. Not talking about it just makes the child feel what they already intrinsically feel. This is my fault. I did something wrong. There's something completely wrong with me. And that is what children feel. Because of the way children's egos are structured and developed, they have absolutely no capacity to understand that it is the adults in their lives that have done something wrong. Small children are what we call remarkably egocentric. If they don't get the candy bar, their life falls apart. If they don't get the toy, life is not worth living. And that works great when your life is okay, when really it's just about the toy or the candy bar. That's normal development. But when you put any type of abuse on top of that, children internalize it and right away think it's their fault. And I'll just kind of end with an anecdote. I do a lot of family therapy. I cannot tell you how many times two parents will get together and tell the child, mommy and Tati or mommy and Abba are splitting up. And the kid right away pipes up. I'll clean up my toys. I'll eat my dinner. As if an entire marriage has been predicated on Legos in the basement. It's the same thing with being molested. I must have done something wrong. So they will not say things for years and years. I have seen people literally want to take this to the grave with them. But because the pain is so real, that's when they start to do acting out behaviors. Alcohol, drugs, sex addiction, gambling, cutting, overeating. Statistics will show you 90% of people who have an addictive process had physical or sexual abuse as a child. That doesn't mean all addicts were abused, but if you were abused as a child, you almost have a straight shot to becoming an addict to something or some things later in your life. And that's where we're at.
I have one more question. I'm sorry. we still have a little time, Judy, right? So, you know, I remember I'm divorced, and I remember when years ago, divorce was not spoken about, and unfortunate clients, well, there are so many divorces. I really just want to touch on how those children wake up with a chip in their heart every morning. So can we just speak about that, please?
I think if I had to put an umbrella, you know, kind of like a little bit of a rubric umbrella under everything that we're talking about today, the emotion that really we are really talking about, and that's what I do for a living, is kind of, you know, name emotion and put it to the situation. The emotion that we're talking about is shame. That's really it. And shame is, I think, the most powerful of the human emotions. Parenthetically, it's the one you're not born with. Baruch Hashem, I do have 11 children. Definitely have my own little study going down here. I remember my newborns. They can be happy. They give you that kind of cute smile. No, it's not gas. I think they're actually like kind of happy. They can be sad. They can be bored. You can kind of recognize that cry where kids are just like, I've had it. Like, you know, just leave me. I'm done. Right. They can be angry. Just kind of take off that stretchy, put them in the bath. I mean, they're really furious with you, and they can be in pain, right? There's that high-pitched shriek that will send any mother bolting in the middle of the night. Like, it's just like, oh, something, but they don't have shame. Children don't have shame. They're not born with any shame. We teach it to them. And according to psychoanalytic theory, and I do kind of buy into that, I do think Freud kind of sort of knew what he was doing. And by the way, if you want to read a family history that will really shock you happily, go read Freud's family history. It's just unbelievable. It'll make you like walk out and be like, whoa, we have no issues. But his family really had some interesting stuff going down in it. We teach children shame. Now, is that necessarily a bad thing? Again, how? We do have to be part of a community. We don't want to raise psychopaths or sociopaths and people that don't understand societal norms. But do we want to raise people who are so drowning and cowering in shame that when we can't fit into the narrative that we think we should, that we literally cannot function anymore, or that our families feel that they are worthless, or they are not eligible to be married, or they're not eligible to be loved? And I think that's where we start to kind of just pull back and look at it. We want children to care. We don't want children to feel shame. It's very different. Very different construct and a very different way of going about dealing with our kids. And I talk a lot with my clients on shame. 90% of the time it comes down to shame. Shame at having had an accident in the second grade and being completely embarrassed and everybody making fun of them. Shame at understanding that they were poor and they knew it and not being able to fit in. Shame at understanding that there wasn't a Tati at home. Nobody was there for them. And I believe in a community such as ours, which is so steeped in chesed, the antidote to shame is normalization. Your parents are divorced, you never taught, come, I'm going to show you, come, I'm taking the boys, you come with me. No fanfare, no big awards needed, no trumpets blaring. I'm on my way, let's go. You'll go to group with Mikey and Dovey. Come on, we'll have kiddush afterwards. Normal, normal. Kids want to feel normal. And we have the capacity.
Thank you. Dr. Ackerman, it's not only the divorced families, but the family, the single parent family, whether they lost a spouse as well, those children really suffer. And we are so lucky to have so many wonderful organizations out there. Sister to Sister, Samcheinu, there's Rifa'enu, there's Chazkenu, there's Friends and Family, there's Catch. For men that peer support, there's for family members with mental illness, there's for people suffering with anxiety. There's so many different organizations, and anyone that wants to know which organization they should be calling for their help, for their family members, their loved ones, their neighbors. You could always, if you're a neighbor, write a name, write mask and the phone number, put it into an envelope, just shove it under their door. Maybe they don't know that we can be helpful to them and their families are struggling. So again, I want to thank the OU, Judy Steinig, my wonderful colleague who is always first and foremost ready on the front lines to help everyone in all situations. It's an honor to be your colleague. Thank you, Judy. Thank you. And I want to thank Dr. Ackerman for being on. I just want to end again with our phone number, 718-758-0400, maskparents.org. Remember, we have resources around the world. Call the helpline, describe what you're going through, and ask how we can help my family member, and we'll give you other ideas. And remember, we have a radio show you can listen to every Thursday night, 9 p.m. on the Zev Brenner station. I'm Label Bistritsky's daughter, and he was one of the founders of Hatzala. And, you know, mental health is another form of Hatzala. And we all need to put out our arms, run to help those that are struggling in one way or the other. And I just want to say that at the end of our parent groups, I had met with Rav Pam Zatzal, and I had asked him about saying a kapitel Tehillim, and we say Perek Chaf. So I'm wondering, Judy, if I could quickly read Perek Chaf. Thank you. For all the cholim, for the tragedy, for all the cholim, Meron and Leila Nishmas, all of those that perished. Let me add for those that are suffering with mental illness as well, please. Amnatzeich mismala David. Yancha adonai b'yam tzara yisagefcha shem Elohe Yaakov. Yishlach ezrecha mekodesh mitzion yisadzecha. Yizkoko minchasecha v'aloscha yadash nesela. Yiteng lecha chavavecha v'chol atas chayim alei. Naranina b'shua secha v'he. Shem Eloheinu Nikol Yimale Adonai Kol Mishalo Secha Ata Yodati Ki Oshia Adonai Mishicha Yanehu Mishmei Kacho B'Bus Yeshayim Yino Eila V'Recha Ve'Eila V'Asasim V'Anachnu B'Shem Adonai Eloheinu Nazkir Heimukaru V'Nafalo V'Anachnu Kanu V'Nisodat Adonai Oshia HaMelech Yanehu B'Yom Kareinu. Thank you.
Thank you very much to you. I really appreciate this. This is a tremendous honor. I saw everybody was really engaged in writing and paying attention. Rahama, thank you so very much for your partnership and your support always. It's an honor to work with you every single week. And to Yiddish and Nachas and good health for everybody. Thank you very kindly.
Amen. Thank you.
Dr. Debbie, Rahama.
Thank you, the OU.
Thank you so much. This was an honor to have. The information that we all received today was unbelievable. Right now, I don't see any questions, although I actually, but there were a couple of comments. So I'm going to ask that you send us your info, that your contact info, and also Nefesh, there was a request for that, plus that list of books. And when we send our recording out later, this will be added to it. So everybody will have everything all together. And, you know, they'll be able to contact you or anybody else. We want to thank everyone for joining us today. On Thursday, we'll be hearing from one of my colleagues at the OU, Rabbi Eli Elif, on Kashrus 101. Now, it's not just basic Kashrus course, because we know nobody needs that here, but I'm sure people are fascinated by how the OU gives certification. There's lots of misconceptions about what could be kosher or how things are done. So Rabbi Elif will be able to share with us that. And as I said last week, I will bet you someone's going to ask a question about Oreo cookies. That seems to be one of their most popular questions. So if you do have questions, put them in your registration and we'll be happy to get it to Rabbi Elif. But you will get the registration for this program when you get the recording of today's program. Now, Ruchama and Dr. Debbie, there aren't questions coming in, just lots of compliments.
Thank you. We have a book list. Judy, we have a book list on our website as well on all mental health topics.
Wonderful. So you'll just give us you'll give me all the contact info and we'll get that out to everybody. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, take care, everybody. Be healthy, be safe, be happy.